Today, an amazing story from our international correspondent Michael Safi, who heard about five brothers displaced across the world by the Syrian war and set out to track them all down. And after another tense week in Westminster, Labour MP Lisa Nandy explains why she wants to see compromise on Brexit. About a decade ago, in the town of Dara in southern Syria, there was a family of five brothers.
They were a family of hairdressers, so whatever else each of them did for a living, they all knew how to cut hair. Rami was the youngest, he was a student, and he was studying accounting. There was Karim, who was sort of political. He was interested in issues, he read a lot, he liked to talk about politics, but he was best known for his beautiful handwriting. He was a great calligrapher, and he would often paint signs and things like that in the neighbourhood. And he ran a hairdressing salon with his brother, Samir. And then there was another brother, Hassan, who also cut hair. And finally, Farid, who was the oldest, and he was in construction. Each of them talked about their life before the war like it was happening to another person, like it was another country. They said that they could never have imagined the things that they would very quickly come to see, you know, a plane dropping a bomb on your house or the sight of everything in your house ransacked and everything stolen, including, in one case, even the children's toys. They were living what was, by any measure, a pretty ordinary, probably lower middle class Syrian life. And then all of that changed really quickly in early 2011. Dara is the place that's credited as being the beginning of the Syrian revolution. There were a few boys, schoolboys, who wrote graffiti on a wall that basically said the Arab leaders who had already fallen, that same thing was coming to Syria. Now, those boys were arrested, they were tortured, and those events sparked protests in Dara. That within a few days had spread even more widely across Syria. And those protests were met with force. First, shooting. And when that didn't stop people, it escalated to tanks and artillery. And then bombing in the air by planes. They spent the month of Ramadan together. They spent it in a bomb shelter with their families, while overhead regime artillery and airstrikes were pounding their neighbourhood, which was besieged at the time. You couldn't get in or out. Within a few days of Ramadan ending, it looked like the Syrian army would soon break into the neighbourhood. And so they split up, the women in one house and then the men, these five brothers, in another. And those few days in late August 2012 were the last time they were all together.
When Syrian army troops broke into the area a few days later, the brothers fled in different directions. Now they find themselves scattered around the world, living in five different countries, facing five very different futures. Nearly 9 years after the first protest broke out in Dara, President Assad is reasserting control. Last week, the regime regained northeastern Syria from the Kurds, and only one pocket of rebel-held territory now remains. Many people think that the war is entering its final phase. But there are still around 5 million Syrian refugees, and many don't know whether they can ever return home. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, the five brothers forced apart by the war in Syria. Our international correspondent Michael Safi set out to track down all five brothers displaced around the world. We'll hear from them, but we've changed their names to protect their safety.
The first brother I met was Farid, who was the oldest. I was told he was in Jordan, and I was sent a small WhatsApp pin to try to figure out where he was. So I got a photographer, got in a car in Amman, and we set out towards the north, towards the Israeli border with Jordan. You seemed to be living somewhere really out of the way, and I guess we were lost, and so my photographer Asmahan had to call him up and ask for directions. So we kept driving as he told us the way. We ended up on a road that was flanked on both sides by dense vegetation, and then right in front of us was this huge mountain range. We drove past a mosque, and then finally at the end of one road was this lone figure, and as we got closer we saw it was Farid.
He looks like a friendly guy.
And he led us down past this property, and all we could see was barbed wire and a really high fence. He opened the gate and we turned into it.
Wow.
Yeah, right? I mean, where are we?
There was this massive, really luxurious, half-built Spanish villa, and it had two pools, a garden full of palm trees, and by the time we went inside, we saw it had a big marble staircase. Farid had been hired off books to build this mansion and was actually living in it. He slept on a mat in one of the bedrooms with his son.
And what did he tell you? How did he end up in Jordan?
After the family had spent Ramadan together, he had chosen to stick it out in his neighbourhood for a little bit, but then said that at some point it became clear that it just wasn't feasible to stay. He said that there were shells falling on the neighbourhood every 5 minutes, so one night he set out in a group of 1,500 families, and in this giant caravan they made their way towards the Jordanian border. And it was, he said, a really dangerous journey.
And they were shelled while they were crossing an area called Al-Nasib, and the area got shelled while they were going to Jordan.
As they passed town, some of them were being bombed. They could see artillery shells crashing nearby, and they did it in the cover of darkness.
And they even made sure not to turn their phones on so the regime doesn't see the light in the dark.
So dark, he said, that everyone was afraid to even light a cigarette, to switch their phone on, for fear of giving their position away, you know, because the whole route was being watched by regime soldiers. You couldn't tell who was around you, whether it was your wife, your daughter, your son. It just became this mass of bodies all rushing towards the Jordanian border.
God, that sounds absolutely terrifying. Was he with his wife and his son?
They quickly became lost, and only in the last town before the border, that was when they found each other and made that very last stretch together, where they were able to claim political asylum in Jordan.
And what happened to him next? How did he make a life in Jordan, and how has it been?
Jordan is one of the better places for Syrian refugees to end up in the region, because it's a country of refugees. Most of its population have actually fled from somewhere else, and so there is a commitment to making the place reasonably hospitable for these new arrivals, which is not to say it's easy. I mean, it's hard for him to find work. He's had to find this work informally, so he's like technically he's working illegally, but he says that he is getting by. I mean, he is able to feed his family. He is relatively safe. There's no threat of deportation. So Farid says he is reasonably happy in Jordan, and he thinks back to these discussions that he had with two of his other brothers who were in Jordan with him at the same time in 2015, and they would sit and debate night after night about what they would do next. And he would argue that it was too dangerous to try to go further than Jordan by boat or by some other smuggling route. And so for him, it was about staying and trying to make Jordan work. But his other two brothers, Karim and Samir, decided to take a different route, and they both took their chances on a trip to Europe.
So two of the brothers decided to embark on this journey to Europe. Have you been able to find them?
Hello? Hey, ماشي الحال. انت قاعد هلا بالألمانيا؟
So the first brother that I tracked down was Samir, who is in a small town in Germany called Bremerhaven. He's been living there for the last year or so, And he got there via a very dangerous boat journey that he took from Turkey to Greece.
Did he tell you what that was like?
He did. He said that it was exactly as you might expect. It was a rickety boat. It was overcrowded. He said they couldn't move for hours. The boat was taking on water. They had paid over $1,000 for the journey. And they knew that people at this stage were dying in their hundreds making this very trip. He said that a couple of days before he made the journey, a boat of 20 or 25 people had sunk on its way to one Greek island, so they just chose a different one. I mean, that was the best they could do and just hope for the best. And despite the odds, he made it. From Greece, he walked. I mean, he was part of these streams of migrants that we saw walking across Europe, trying to make it to Germany, where he had heard the treatment was better, where people were kinder, and he would be able to have a safe life.
And he took that journey with his family. I mean, what was he hoping to achieve that made him want to take that risk?
So he was relatively safe when he was in Jordan, but he was struggling economically. I mean, he couldn't find work. And one of the things he told me was that his child by that stage was 6 years old and had never learned to read, so he'd never really been to school. And so he figured that there was not really a future for this kid, and therefore, even though the risk was, I mean, it was everything, it was dying, it was one worth taking because he didn't feel like the life he could have had in Jordan was one that was worth living.
Is his child being educated in Germany?
Yes. In fact, when I was trying to line him up to chat, we had to do it around his kids' karate classes. So, yeah. So there's, I mean, it's a completely different life that they're living, which is not to say it's perfect, but it's just a universe away from what they were facing in Syria and even in, you know, a better place like Jordan.
Okay, that's Samir. I'd really like you to tell me about Karim because you described him at the beginning as being the more political one in the family. Tell me more about him.
أهلا صديقي. كيف الحال؟
احنا بالمنتصف بين ستوكهولم
و. He owned a hairdressing salon, but then when the war broke out, he said that he would be the one who would write a lot of the protest signs that would be broadcast then around the world and printed in newspapers. He said that he graduated to being what he called a media activist. And he took up that position because the guy who used to do it was arrested by the Syrian Secret Service and they never saw him again. He had a YouTube page that he sent me the link for videos that spanned 2 or 3 years. Many of them show Karim walking through rubble, so it would be the aftermath of a bombed-out building. And he's talking about who used to live in this building, about the destruction it caused, about the casualties. Or some kind of government attack. And he would send these tapes to TV stations, mostly in the Gulf, and they would be broadcast across the Arab world and then sometimes across the entire world. And he knew that when he took this job on, it was crossing a red line. I mean, it's one thing to write signs, but he knew that as soon as he started to appear on camera, as soon as his voice was heard on camera, then he would be known to the regime. His picture would be known to them. There would be a file on him and there would be a file on his entire family. And so, you know, he spoke to me in Arabic the entire time, except for this one phrase that he knew in English.
Freedom or death.
Freedom or death. When he started becoming a media activist, he said, they became his two choices. Pretty quickly, the regime started to look for him and started to look for members of his family. And he said that he had to dispatch his wife and children over the border to Jordan, and he himself didn't sleep at home for 2 years. He would sleep in a different series of safe houses, and the location of those safe houses came to be known. He said to me that the regime started to know where I slept, and so he knew that it was time to leave. And he crossed the border over to Jordan, and he applied for asylum with the French embassy there. In the meantime, his wife and children went down to Libya, he told me, and they decided to try to cross from Libya into Europe. And he said that at one stage, he didn't hear from them for 2 days. And he was beginning to grapple with the idea that they might have died until he got a phone call from Europe. And he was told that the family had made it.
What was that phone call like when his wife and kids got in touch with him?
He said it was like being born again. It was something that, he was beginning to try to accept the idea that his family might be dead. And so it was everything for him. After a little while, the French got back to him and said that he had qualified for political asylum on the basis of his activism. And he was able to fly to France, and he's now settled in Sweden, which is where his wife and kids were.
It's just so astonishing what you're telling me. You know, you think of ordinary lives all over the world, and that's what they had in their life in Syria. Their families separated in absolutely terrifying journeys to pass places that are being bombed and to cross the waters to finally find somewhere that they can find peace. I mean, has Karim found peace in Sweden?
Well, he said he hadn't, unfortunately, because he still has brothers in danger. He is still worried every day about the two brothers who he left behind in Syria.
Those brothers, I assume, are Rami and Hassan, who you started introducing us to at the beginning of this. What paths have they taken? Why didn't they follow their three brothers to Jordan?
So Rami and Hassan were the two that stayed behind. You know, it struck me talking to Rami in particular that when something like a civil war breaks out in your country, you're confronted with choices that have giant implications. And at the time, maybe you can't understand that. You just think you're making, you know, the day-to-day decisions of your life, but actually the ramifications are huge. So he said that when the revolution began and the backlash started, there was always this sense that it could be quick, that things were going to improve. The kind of all-out destruction and brutality that it became, I mean, that was a hard thing to comprehend at the beginning. And so rather than flee to Jordan when his neighborhood fell, he decided to continue his studies. So he went to another town, a town that was regime held, but where he could keep a low profile. And he continued going to university because he said to me that he wanted to have a degree. He wanted to be able to have a chance to have a lucrative future. While Rami had been studying, the rebel group in their area, the Free Syrian Army, had retaken their neighborhood. And so he was able to go back there, where he rejoined his brother Hassan, who had also stayed behind. And for a couple of years, Rami worked with different international aid organizations to deliver food and water and medicine to people, until the middle of 2018, when the Syrian government, which by that point was very quickly retaking big parts of the country, swept through Dara, including through their neighborhood, and they knew that it was time to go.
Did they tell you what life was like in Syria over that period?
It was horrific. It was, you know, bombings every day, people being shot. Hassan himself was injured in a bombing, and then he was also shot with a Kalashnikov, Rami told me. It was just too dangerous for them to stick around.
So how did they leave?
It was Karim in Sweden and Samir in Germany who pulled together a bit of cash for Rami to escape. There wasn't enough money for Rami and Hassan to both go. So the two brothers had to choose who went first, and they decided it would be Rami. So he and his family fled to Beirut, which is where I met Rami a few weeks ago. I met him on a pretty busy side street in one of the poorer neighbourhoods of the city, and he led me into what I thought was initially a garage, but at the back of the garage was some stairs. At the very top of the stairs, in a building that looked like it had been just sort of hastily thrown on top of another building, were these two rooms where Rami was living with his wife and his two baby daughters. His kids were watching some TV show. And it was loud and it was hot and a pretty sort of sparse place to live.
Okay, by this point, you'd managed to track down four of the five brothers. Did Rami tell you whether his brother Hassan was able to get out of Syria and join him in Beirut?
So by April this year, there was enough money to also pay a smuggler to take Hassan out of Syria. And so he arrived in Beirut in late April, a few months after Rami had arrived. And his timing, unfortunately, was not very good because the Lebanese government had declared on April 24 that any Syrian refugees, any Syrians who arrived in the country after that date would be sent back, because Lebanon has had to bear the heaviest brunt of the Syrian crisis of any country other than Syria. I mean, something like at some point 40% of its population were Syrian refugees. And it was initially very, you know, willing to accommodate them. The countries have a lot of ties. But after nearly 9 years, and with Lebanon facing a pretty severe financial crisis, the atmosphere has turned really quickly against the Syrians in the country. There's a strong feeling that as the war has started to enter a new phase where most of the country has been pacified, that it's time for the Syrians to start heading back, to go back and resume their lives. And so Hassan arrived in a city which I think had really run out of patience for fleeing Syrians. He managed to initially find a job with a friend, and he did that for about 3 months. And then he went to work one morning in July, and he never came back. He just disappeared. At first, Rami said he wasn't concerned because, you know, Syrians were frequently being picked up in Beirut. They were held for a few days and then released, maybe with some kind of documentation. But then when Hassan didn't resurface, Rami said he called the local office of the UN's refugee agency, and they told him that there was no record of Hassan in Lebanese custody and that he should urgently call the Red Cross. And he said that was when he got scared. That was when he realized that this wasn't just a routine arrest. And so the four brothers frantically tried to figure out where Hassan had gone, and it was actually Karim who, through a contact, found an official in the regime who offered to tell him where Hassan was, but in exchange for $5,000. And so the scramble was on to gather that money. The brothers had to get loans, and they managed to get the $5,000 together and discovered that Hassan had been arrested, he had been deported, and he was being held in a Syrian military intelligence facility.
Do we know what life was like in prison for him?
I asked the brothers if Hassan had told them what it was like in there, and they all said he was really evasive. He didn't really talk much about it. And it was Karim who said that Hassan told him that whatever you think prison is, exactly as you imagine it, that's what it's like.
What happened to Hassan?
The brothers managed to get, in the end, it was about $20,000, so total $25,000 together, which was the price of paying a bribe to get Hassan out. So now Hassan has been freed and he is no longer in custody, but says that he is terrified. I mean, he doesn't sleep at home. He's scared that at any point he could be rearrested, that, you know, his situation is the kind of absolute worst case for the family.
He's in Syria on his own.
Yeah, on his own, exactly. They have some, you know, other family members there, like distant family, but for the most part, he is on his own.
Did you try to speak to Hassan?
Yeah, I asked the four brothers I spoke to if there was any potential to speak to Hassan, but they say that it's impossible. He barely speaks to them. You know, when they can reach him, he's evasive. All he's told them is that Rami is in danger, that the government knows that he's in Beirut, that he needs to just avoid being arrested in any way he can.
Is Rami taking that message on board from Hassan? I mean, he's there with his baby girls. Is he worried about the thought of going back to Syria?
Yeah, Rami says that he barely leaves the house, only when he has to. I mean, he's afraid that, like his brother, he could just go out for a routine, you know, a grocery shop visit and just not return. He says he lives in fear and he's begging the UN and others to try to find a way to get him out. And he says that if he could find a way out, if he could jump on a boat in Lebanon and end up somewhere else, he would do it. He's absolutely desperate. He knows what the alternative is now. He knows that if he is arrested, you know, the very best case is he'll be forced to serve in the army, which he doesn't want to do. The worst case is he'll disappear into this prison system.
Hassan spent weeks in prison, had to pay a bribe to get out, and seems to be having a really difficult life in Syria. And Rami is living in fear that this might be his fate too if he ever ends up back there. Do we know why Hassan and Rami are being targeted by the Syrian authorities?
Yes, it was primarily, the brothers say, in connection to Karim's activism. they're wanted, basically.
So when we were talking about Karim earlier, and you told me that he hadn't been able to find peace in Sweden because he was worried about the brothers he'd left behind in Syria, it sounds as if he was right to be worried about them. I mean, clearly what he did, his political action, was an incredibly brave thing to do, and many would say incredibly important. But it has had dire consequences for his brothers. Does he regret any of it?
I asked him this and he didn't. He said that basically they had no choice, that this was, I mean, he felt that he had an obligation to fight for what he thought was right. They wanted to be free, and anything short of that was just couldn't be accepted. It was unacceptable.
Does he feel guilty?
I think he does, yeah. I would say he feels a sense of duty. That was how he put it to me, but tied up with that, I'm sure, is a sense of guilt that the choices he made impacted others. And the only point in the conversation that he really got fired up was when he was telling me about his brothers who haven't made it to a safe place and who still face danger.
What does this story of devastation in one family tell us about the depth of the displacement caused by this war?
Well, I guess it reminds us that the story is very far from over for Syrians. Even for those who have managed to escape the country, you know, their families have been shattered. You know, each one of them, each person had to make a choice, and those choices have been enormously consequential. You know, do you run now, or do you bet that things will get better and stay and keep studying like Rami did? Or do you get on a boat the way that Samir did? Do you stick around a place like Jordan and try and make the best of it there? I mean, all these decisions will shape the course of these people's lives for the rest of their lives. And there's going to be increased pressure to return in the next few months and years, and many will happily go back, but a lot won't. And there will be this ongoing struggle to avoid retribution from the government and to try to survive in Syria and to try and make a new life in a new country and to reunite families like this one that have been scattered across the whole world.
Do you think the five brothers will ever be reunited? And if so, is there any chance that it could be in Syria?
All of the four brothers that I spoke to said that they did not see a way they could return to Syria anytime soon. They're all struggling financially. The brothers in Europe are now in deep debt because of the $25,000 they had to pay to free Hassan. I mean, when I raised that question with Samir, the brother in Germany, he broke down crying.
Be Ahmed Khan.
He said that, of course, he would love to. He would love to see his brothers again, the rest of his family. But he just doesn't see how to do it. He doesn't see what path would lead them there. He can't see beyond that day and that week and just trying to survive and to forge this new life for his family. And Karim was telling me that he's had a fourth child since he arrived in Sweden. And he was just marveling at the fact that this young girl, I mean, she was born in Sweden. She knows nothing about Syria, about her family, about all these things that they experienced. And so the idea of taking her back to Syria seems impossible. They want to be together again as a family, but they just don't see how that could happen. So for the near or medium future, at least, it looks like they'll still be separated.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thanks.
That was Michael Safi. He has written a brilliant piece about these five brothers. Do go to theguardian.com and read it. Coming up, a Labour MP on her party's Brexit dilemma. Now, Boris Johnson says he'll agree to giving MPs more time to debate the Brexit deal, but they have to agree to a general election on December the 12th. As the EU considers how long of an extension it is prepared to give Britain, Labour MP Lisa Nandy explains why she voted in favour of getting Johnson's withdrawal agreement bill to its next stage in Parliament.
We've spent 3 years deferring difficult decisions because the parties are divided and Parliament is divided, and in fact the country is divided too. And as a consequence, we've got to a place where we only have difficult choices ahead of us. So far, Parliament has been in the grip of two extremes, people who want to stop Brexit and people who want a no-deal Brexit. And on each side, they've spent 3 years knocking out any attempts at compromise in the middle, so that any type of soft Brexit deal that MPs like me have been trying to achieve has become impossible. A few months ago, we voted down every single option before Parliament as a Parliament. And as a consequence, the public are sick and tired of us. And people feel, quite frankly, that the country is at breaking point. They can't take any more. We're not going to get everything we want. None of us are. Because the truth is, there are only difficult options from here on in. But every time we've deferred making those difficult decisions over the last 3 years, things have got worse. It's brought us to the point where we've got a hard Brexit in front of us, or the potential for a no-deal Brexit. We have to get real and start to understand the gravity of the situation before us. There are no easy options from here. Every path that this country can choose has costs. But that, for me, is what politics is all about. It's about dealing with the reality before us and actually trying to find a way to navigate through some very difficult choices and make some very difficult trade-offs. I accept that any form of Brexit deal is problematic. I wouldn't vote for a hard Brexit. I've done my utmost to stop a no-deal Brexit. But I think we do have to get serious and think, how can we get this bill to a state in which it will protect people in this country and uphold the result of the referendum? I firmly believe that the democratic harm that would be done by seeking to stop or block the referendum result, to try to go back to the country with a second referendum before there's been any serious attempt at all in Parliament to implement the result of the first, the repercussions of that would last for decades and decades to come. As a Labour MP, I feel very strongly that I'm elected in order to protect some of the most vulnerable, most marginalised people in the country, people who work hard, who earn low wages, who are discriminated against and disadvantaged. Those people can't take much more of this. A bad Brexit deal will not help them, but that's why I believe that we have a duty to work constructively and compromise to see if there is a way that we can make this Brexit deal better and protect the people that I represent and many others around the country from the worst excesses of a hard Tory Brexit.
That was Lisa Nandy, and this story is clearly carrying on. Do follow it all on Andrew Sparrow's Politics live blog and with our reporters in Westminster, Brussels and elsewhere. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.